So yeah, so I was quite inspired by the discussion of enchantment at the last stop. And one of the things Marisa asked me to talk about today is I've had the good fortune twice now of helping to run a seminar that's been funded by the NEH, the National Endowment for the Humanities, called Reenchanting Nature, Humanities Perspectives. And what we do at Carroll is each time we run the seminar, we're able to bring in 16 elementary, high school, and middle teachers from across the country to do a three-week seminar at Carroll where we do a number of different readings in the humanities around the topic of nature. These are all teachers who are looking to find ways to better approach topics about nature in humanities curricula. So mostly English teachers who want to do a unit on environmental literature or history, professors who want to be able to speak about the history of, let's say, land use and laws, etc. And then we take them around to various places around Montana. We spend a week in Yellowstone with an ecologist and with Shane Doyle, who does a lot of stuff that many of you know well for all he does with kind of crow history in that area. And so our discussion actually was very inspiring to me, in part because it made me reflect on how we kind of came to this idea of re-enchanting nature. And I wanted to just maybe reflect a little bit on some things I've learned from working with people from different areas and backgrounds through this seminar. And one of the things I think to say straight out is you were mentioning how there are like bad definitions of enchantment. I think we actually chose the word without thinking about it a whole lot. The first essay we read in that seminar is a lecture by Wendell Berry where he talks about affection for nature, right? And really our guiding theme in many ways is affection. And affection for Berry is very much the line that always sticks out to me is he says, you know, affection requires that we can imagine ourselves in nature. Which I just think is a really interesting verb choice, right? That you actually kind of have to imagine ourselves in nature and not just kind of take it for granted. And affection for him becomes very much tied up with a kind of ethical program, right? Like you're supposed to see your good as tied up with the good of nature, your desires as tied up with the desires of the place, become very rooted in it. And so one of the guiding questions for us in that three-week seminar is, what do different types of affection for nature look like? What are we actually kind of desiring? What are we caring about when we say we care about nature? You know, what do you care about when you look at an Ansel Adams, you know, photo versus what do you care about when you hear a, you know, origin story from the crow versus what do you care about, what do you like to care about. But we can't use the word affection in our title because it sounds very prescriptive, and one of the things that federal government says is that you can't tell people what to think in these seminars, right? Like, if you say, you know, affection for nature, it sounds like you're saying you should leave here loving nature, and you can't actually do that. So we thought enchantment actually sounded a little less prescriptive. Like enchantment does kind of demand a response. I think it is prescriptive, but it sounds more open-ended and wonder-like. But I think we've always kind of assumed those things are together. And again, hearing many of your responses about fellow feeling or about respect or kind of I kept thinking as Henry was talking, right? It is, there's something about enchantment that assumes a kind of other subjectivity, mm-hmm. right? And even if that subjectivity is not personified, you don't think there's actually like persons or spirits there, right? There is a kind of other subject that demands respect or reverence or regard. As I was preparing for today, I think in doing the seminar twice again with school teachers who are very much concerned with how do we communicate this kind of affection for nature to children, how do we enchant them? A few things that have stood out to me as kind of my own list of elements for enchantment. And I kind of like the wonder piece that Henry brought up. But one of the things I think we overlook sometimes, let me start maybe back a little bit. One thing that I think is just telling for me, that probably won't be surprising most other people, is how important encounter is. I tend to look at perfection when we talk about it, or enchantment when we talk about it, very conceptually, is what I do for a living. Right? So I set up this seminar and I say, like, there's this way of defining nature, and this is what it makes you feel. And there's this way of defining nature, and that's what it makes you feel. And this is the way of defining it. And that's great, and it's beautiful, and it goes really well. And then we just bring people outside and they have an encounter with this, and that is actually where the enchantment happens. And it. So I think that notion of encounter, and I'd like to think that our the narrative arc we provide in the seminar helps that. We read lots of different things, Dickens, all kinds of stuff. But I think that the importance of encounter can't be taken for granted. The other thing I think is really important is, and we've gotten to it a little bit, is narrative. Right? I am always struck in working with these participants how much they write. During the experience, how much everybody's encounter with nature ends up becoming something of an autobiography. So everybody starts telling their story of their relationship to the natural world, whether it's one that took it for granted or one that was very integrated from the start. People write a lot. I think the importance of narrative and autobiography. So I like the idea of enchantment as kind of being a response to the song. Right, that it kind of does demand us to kind of bring ourselves into that story and have a relationship, or borrow other narratives. I always share the story of the participant who went to, you know, we took him to Berkeley Pit, and he said, okay, this is now I understand Dante going into hell. Like, this is Dante going into hell. And I thought that, you know, what that image brought to his experience there and allowed him to see. I think the importance of just a narrative. Some other things that are maybe more surprising for me, I think it's important to, and I don't know if this directly maps onto enchantment, but I think it's worth mentioning. I think there's a level of acceptance and kind of reckoning that's involved in kind of enchantment. So many of our participants, as they're having these wonderful experiences of just falling in love with nature and being enchanted and seeing mystery, at the same time are just kind of learning to look seriously and look honestly, and look without blinking, as it were, at some of what we're responsible for, right? We have this lovely seminar on nature, and half of what we talk about are Superfund sites. It's actually powerful for me to hear from participants that, like, actually kind of learning to look at that without looking away. That's also kind of part of enchantment, right? That's maybe a kind of ethic of responsibility that comes along with enchantment, right? Somebody mentioned, living the mystery, right? And part of living that, I think, is just having a really clear-eyed, honest vision of what's wonderful and what's maybe tragic. I think, you know, encounter and narrative and acceptance, and maybe not acceptance in terms of condoning something, but at least kind of honesty in vision, I think is a really important part in enchantment. And the other thing we wrestle with a lot, and then I'll hand over to Henry, and this is kind of an open question for me. I don't actually know if this is good or bad, but we talk a lot in that seminar about the relationship between kind of enchantment or affection for the natural world and curated experiences. Like, we bring people in for a three-week seminar in this gorgeous area, and we have a very curated, we read this, and then we go here, and we read this, and we go here, and View It As Your Descent Into Hell, and East Helen is actually coming out a little bit, right? Right? And then we take you to Yellowstone, and there's a certain story we're telling. And when I think that many of these teachers go think about how they're going to take it back to their students, sure, they have things they want to read with them or projects they want to do, but a lot of it is also, like, I have these kids on the west side of Chicago, and their idea of nature is not this, right? And I want to kind of curate an experience that allows them to see their natural environment in a way that they haven't seen before. And it's all good. I mean, I actually think curation makes a lot of sense. You know, I don't think most of us would have any access to things like national parks if the Park Service didn't really kind of script your experience, right? And I think there's something powerful there. And yet there's something a little bit uncomfortable if all of our, like, access to enchantment is modeled for us, right? So how do we think, I mean, for me it's always a struggle of how to think about enchantment in a way that can be democratic, frankly, right? That we can bring a lot of people into this kind of these other relationships with the world to kind of see themselves related to something that's not just kind of objective, dead, cold matter, right? But how do we wrestle with our kind of own hand in that, and actually kind of let whatever kind of subjectivity is out there that we're encountering kind of speak for itself, let the mystery speak for itself. Is that even desirable? Is that a goal? Do we need that? Maybe that's too romantic, I think, right? These experiences are going to not be somewhat a blend of the natural and the artificial. But I think that's somewhere where I wrestle now in terms of thinking about enchantment. What's it look like authentically? What are we asking for? And how much of it is a kind of program we can do for people, right? And how much of it is something that we need to let be a little bit more, spontaneous. So those are just kind of some thoughts I've had as we've been reflecting today.
I really liked that you returned to that notion of subjectivity and of seeing the world as a, we're used to seeing the world as a bunch of passive, dead things that, and then we can. It just made me think of, there's an Irish writer who I probably mentioned on other walks, John Moriarty, who uses a lot of literature and mythology and things to bring in a certain kind of connection. And he has this wonderful way of describing that Western mindset of seeing everything as dead and passive. He calls it a Medusa mindset. And what does Medusa do? Everything she looks at turns to stone. And he says that's what we carry around. I think that's such a wonderful way of sort of embodying, like, imagining that. Like, that when we look at things, when we look at that tree, the way we think about that tree, our gaze turns it to stone. And then suddenly it's immobilized, and it can't interact with us, it can't reach out to us, it can't draw us in. I don't know, I like that as a very enchanted sort of way of describing what that mindset is like, and I think it really concretizes it. didn't mean the pun there, but... also to sort of talk on that subjectivity point a little bit before diving into wonder in specific. Back to you brought up the root of enchantment as to chant, and the thing about I'm not sure how fully I responded. I might be repeating myself a little bit here, but. That notion of seeing into of language of ways of speaking, that is one half of that goal of speaking differently about things so that we can see them and change our ways of relating to it is one part of that enchanting of that chanting. The other part is giving speech to the things around us, giving agency, meaning. I mean, our notion of meaning is very bonded with our notion of language and speech. Meaningful language is the way we articulate what things mean to us. And so to give language to the things around us, to hear the wind as a voice, to hear the tree as speaking to you, as able to reach out to you and talk to you meaningfully with meaningful speech, I think is another aspect of enchantment that gives that. And I just wanted to refresh on that. To this notion of wonder, I'm not doing anything exciting, I'm just getting out my notebook again. there's a couple more quotes that I wanted to read.
Thank God for the iPhone.
Yeah, right? So, regarding how this can affect our behavior to the things around us again, Jane Bennett has a good line where she writes, "If enchantment can foster an ethically laudable generosity of spirit, then the cultivation of an eye for the wonderful becomes something like an academic duty." I thought I had something else here too. That goal of cultivating an eye for the wonderful, like, what does that actually mean? What does that actually look like? We talked about the role of the humanities. I spoke a little bit on the last stop about how story and things can shift our relationship, and the intellectual arts of our tradition can sort of inform and shape and change us and help us to grow in directions that cultivate that sense of wonder. But I think that there, and enchantment, but I think that there is also a sort of concrete, like embodied sort of exercise. Like you said, we could, at your seminar, you talked often about the different ways that you could think about nature, but what really worked was people getting out there and experiencing it, and that led to things that shifted them. That experience itself shifts your orientation towards the thing. So I'm working currently a lot with wonder, and my notion of wonder sort of is paired with this notion of judgment. It's sort of the this notion of judgment is sort of how we go about the world, applying labels and names to things, and then we dismiss them. Like, that's a tree, these are rocks, this is the ground, those are mountains, that's a cliff, this is the water tower, water tower? Is it?
No, it's a water tank.
Water tank. Okay. Incorrect label then, which would mean I would need to revise my judgment, but I'm still just as judgmental
but
towards
what
it.
Is a label?
Yeah. Exactly, we put it on there. And so what these judgments allow us to do is they allow us to move about the world efficiently. Because once you've judged something, once you've decided that you know what it is, it means you are controlling and containing everything that it is or could be. You're limiting its possibilities to what you've decided it is, which makes it easy to move about and behave in response to those things, because you have a really concrete, really like sure of itself orientation towards those things. But of course, there's a drawback. When you've judged something, you, by definition, are no longer attending to it. You don't see it. The only way you can respond to it is by either using it for its use that you've decided it has, or not using it any longer. But your judgment can be broken. It can be loosened or suspended in a few different ways. One of those ways is by surprise. You might see a rock and just barely notice it and just dismiss it as a rock, but when it sprouts legs and scurries away, there's a moment when you have to, when you are lost, when you have an experience of wonder and of enchantment, where you feel like there's this mystery, until you're like, oh, it's just a hermit crab, and then you stick another label on it. So the things themselves can shock you out of your judgments of them. But you can also actively cultivate a suspension of that judgment. And I think one of the ways that you can cultivate that suspension is through attending to the thing itself, by looking, by listening, by letting go of how you would normally assume that thing is or ought to be or ought to behave, and allowing it to present itself to you in new ways. And I think that, by definition, all kinds of attention do this. Even if it's just rote sort of investigative attention, like, well, what color is that rock? There's still a moment of suspension where before I looked at that rock and was like, oh, that rock is red. Before that, they were just all rocks. They were bland. They were colorless. They were rock and only rock. I had to suspend that judgment a little bit and feel just the tiniest amount of wonder in the small sense of wondering what color it is, in order to assign that second judgment. So I think that this applies to all kinds of attention, but there's a certain profound sort of attention of letting go of that completely and allowing it to be something, letting go of our preconceptions about what it could possibly be, and allowing just our immediate interaction with it to guide us. This is also supported, so Joe Sachs is a translator of Aristotle, and he has this really interesting line in his introduction to Nicomachean Ethics. Sachs writes that the sense of wonder seems to me to be the way of seeing which allows things to appear as what they are, since it holds off our tendencies to make things fit into the theories or opinions we already hold, or to use things for the purposes that have nothing to do with them. So wonder is sort of inherently linked to attention there, to seeing things as they are, to allowing things to be what they are. And so to sort of help us feel out what this orientation might look like, I have a couple of brief exercises. The first one is I want to just, and these might be a little similar to the exercises that we did a few weeks ago at the Walk on Story and Imagination, but with a few differences. I'm gonna pass around this rock, And I want, if everyone's comfortable with it, you don't have to share if you don't want to. But attend to this rock. Look at it, feel it, taste it, listen to it. And then say something you've noticed about it. And also say how noticing that made you feel. Even if it's just a small thing. Or if that's a little bit, if that might be difficult to articulate, just maybe associate your observation with an emotion. Just for instance, pointy, dangerous, like fear, something.
Stranger, because it's not from here.
Some little spot sparkles when it catches the sun.
What does it feel like? Feels like sparkles.
You can give it a name, Sparky.
Yeah, it's a, you know, it appears to be ancient, right? It's a sedimentary, very ancient rock. It makes me think of the conditions under which, you know, something fine settling on the bottom of a body of water somewhere. And then there's billions of years of pressure comes into this, and then it gets chipped from somewhere else. You're right, it's not from around here. It's hauled in and dumped up here as part of the fill. But it makes me think of the history of this thing, you know, a couple of billion years perhaps, or at least hundreds of millions. Yeah.
You know, it doesn't make any sound.
But it's a good observation.
If you were to throw it and it were to hit against something else, you would hear a sound.
Try it.
Well, yeah, after it goes around. No, I was also expecting it to be warm because people had already handled it, and yet it's still cold.
How does that make you feel?
You know, I try to see things from an entirely different perspective. I wonder, it is inanimate, but you know, it's made of atoms. Are they inanimate? Is this truly an inanimate object, or is it alive?
Yeah. What emotion does feeling the cold associate? What do you associate that with?
I don't know, brisk, you know,
brisk.
I'm outdoors, which, in today's society, I don't get to very often. So I actually feel, more in tune with being out here, and it actually makes me feel happy.
Nice.
I don't know, the shape reminds you kind of an arrowhead a little bit.
Now, I'm not expecting anybody to have profound emotional... When I'm asking for emotions, I'm not expecting some mystical encounters with the rock, but just the, like, sort of associations of, you know, how people associate colors with emotions, like, just the sensation, oh, it's rough, that feels a little bit jarring or something, or, oh, it's, you know, it's glinting, like you said, maybe that feels lighthearted. Just any associations you might have.
I thought it was gray, but there's some orange red in it.
Green.
Comfy.
my finger on the smell, but it's like being in a wet cave, kind of. Mm. And it makes me feel a longing.
Mm.
I'm so used to being amazed at everything I see. I'm really interested in, I see pits that could be iron, and the green, maybe olivine. So, so this says to me that this came from very deep in the earth. Undoubtedly billions of years old. And that impresses me. I feel impressed by it. Mm. Love me, love me.
Do you feel pressed?
Pressed upon you?
Yeah. M or D?
Well, scientifically, as far as from a geologic perspective, it's been touched on what atoms are in here, what elements, what molecules, and the names, the common names that we apply to these molecules. And that this rock has come from somewhere else. What is its life story? And it's going to be here long after we're all gone. And the lesson of time and the lesson of our immortality and a lesson teaching to us of our humility. Because this rock has its own importance just like we do, but we're just creatures, nothing more, and this rock is here and will be.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
I like everything that you're saying. Did you think of that? Was that your experience when you met the rock, when you got it, or was that what you were thinking about saying about the rock?
Well, I'm just kind of starting from the point of the science of it.
Yeah.
And then going on from there as far as the thought about, if you will, time immemorial of that rock.
Right.
And what
yeah.
it represents to me, particularly of being, yes, not just that rock, but looking at strata of rocks and the lessons of time, which this rock portrays.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Incredible
okay.
time.
Yeah. I just want to make sure that, because part of the challenge of the exercise is to have the rock tell you something, to have
right.
the rock present something to you that might not, that could only be discovered through attention, not just thinking about it or something. But it does sound like, yeah, it portrayed that strata and everything to you.
Yeah, the science of it.
Many people have mentioned kind of the pointiness, but it's got somewhat surprising kind of curvaceous indentations kind of on its surface, non kind of angular pockets. And that makes me feel curious.
Yeah, so we all have a very, like, we all now have a connection to this rock. So I assume that when I just did that, some of you felt a little sad about it.
Yeah.
I can't find that rock. We're not going to, yeah. So,
wow.
Attention. Enchantment with things. I know, right? So it affects the way that we view and relate to these things around us. The changing our orientation, changing the ways we attend to things, changing what we allow them to be, really affects how we care about them. And also,
how I care about you.
What's that?
And how I care about you.
Right, because I'm the monster who just threw it away. But think about that this is a practice in general to all the things around you, that just by attention, just by looking and just reflecting on how that makes you feel, how that encounter makes you feel, you can really build a connection to anything around you. And that when we come to them with these preconceptions, it really sort of inhibits our ability to feel that care and to feel that connection and sympathy with these things we encounter. Another aspect, separate from just cultivating that connection, I would hope that, I mean, we were keeping pretty grounded with what the rock was, with it as a rock, but there might be a way, I mean, if we sort of go a little bit further with this suspension, that if we're combining attention with our own feelings and emotions and not really distinguishing between how it makes us feel or what we associate with it and what it's presenting to us, then at a certain point, there starts to be this sort of transformation, this sort of melding of possibilities, where the rock or whatever else could be so many other things. And this is where like imagination and wonder sort of come into play and interact with one another. So I want to give another really short exercise if we have time. And this one is to sort of take that same attitude, like not to lose that sense of attention, but through looking at something and just sort of meeting it, I want, and you can choose anything. Everyone could choose a different thing here. I wanted us to come stop by this water tower because I think this would be a great option for anybody for this exercise. Or really, so it doesn't need to be nature. It could be anything. And using that attention, allow the thing to be five other things that it's not. Just let it sort of transform. Like, this could be an alien landing pad. This could be, and you know, it could be anything. Let your imagination just sort of run wild with it. But keep in mind that to come up with any of these things, the thing itself has something to say about it. I wouldn't have said this was an alien landing pad if it didn't look like my associations of UFOs. I have to attend to it even to just have that association. So it's not entirely projection. You're allowing this thing to sort of, but anyway, I've said enough about it, but, so yeah, just, and then once you've allowed it to be five or six or as many as you like different things, keep maybe one or two of them that you like, that you feel most strongly resonate with the thing you are trying to imagine out, and just to share with other people, like of what something has become or turned into. Yeah, anyway.